Episode 10 of the School Psych Finds podcast, Specific Learning Disabilities. Welcome to School Psych Finds, the podcast, a show where we'll explore various topics related to the fields of psychology, education, human development, and of course, school psychology. I'm your host, Sophia, a nationally certified school psychologist, and these are my School Psych Finds. Welcome back to the School Psych Finds podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about specific learning disabilities, and that's as defined in special education law, so IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Act, for public education schools and what is commonly known as IEPs. It's important to note that this is not to be considered with the very similarly sounding and somewhat similar process of a private diagnosis of a specific learning disorder, which is slightly different than how the qualification process works in the school settings for a specific learning disability. The semantics are confusing, and I know that can be really frustrating and challenging for families and educators, but I just want to be really clear on what we're talking about today. So today we're going to give an overview of a specific learning disability for special education purposes, and we're also going to talk about some of the issues that are in the field of psychology really around this identification of specific learning disabilities and or disorders. If you haven't listened to episode 2 of the podcast, Intro to Special Education Law, please make sure you go back and listen to that before you listen to this episode, because that has a lot of really important contextual information that I need to make sure we're all on the same page about before we talk about specific learning disabilities. That's especially important if you are a graduate student or not a school psychologist listening to this episode. You need to really understand IDEA law and how we're talking about it in the context of a specific learning disability. Before we begin, I want you to know that the acronym for specific learning disability is SLD. That's the shorthand for it, and you're going to hear me using that term. So if I say SLD, know that I'm talking about specific learning disability. Now, a couple quick disclaimers before we begin. SLD is federally defined under IDEA, and that's the special education law. But as most federal laws in general, and most special education laws that are at a federal level, states have the ability to somewhat modify and kind of sculpt and interpret those laws and kind of make them their own as long as they're within the confines of the federal law. And so if you've been listening to my podcast, if you've been following me closely, you know that I often say that topics related to school psychology are extremely difficult to talk about on a more general, global, national level because they can vary so significantly by state, because each state can have very different laws, and it can also vary really significantly by school district and then by the practice of the school psychologists within those school districts and their training. And the same thing's going to apply here when we're talking about specific learning disabilities. All of those kind of caveats and challenges certainly come into play, which makes that really challenging for the field, but also for families, because you can qualify for special education for a learning disability in one state and potentially not in another, or with one school psychologist or private psychologist and not another. Lastly, in terms of a disclaimer that I want people to really keep in mind here, and that I think is the easiest to forget when we're talking about specific learning disabilities, is that SLD is a psychological construct. Just like most DSM disorders, this is also one of those. And so that doesn't mean that it's not real, and it doesn't mean that there's not some substantial research behind some of the learning disability areas and neuroscience where we actually can see some of the differences in the brains of people with learning disabilities, some of the types of learning disabilities. But what it means is that this is a constantly evolving, growing area, and it's based off of a compilation of a bunch of different symptoms and data points that may indicate a disorder. after careful consideration and evaluation by a trained professional, such as a psychologist. And that's the case, like I said, with almost every single one of the DSM diagnoses. And it's a little bit easier for people to wrap their heads around that when it comes to things like if you're going to get a diagnosis of like depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder, right? We know that it's not a black and white yes or no test. There's not a blood test for it, right? There's not like a gene test necessarily that's like, yes, you have this disorder. And so that's the same with a specific learning disability or disorder actually. And at the end of the episode, we're going to talk about some of the issues, and there are a lot of big issues in the theories and applications of identifying learning disorders and disabilities. But for now, we're going to talk about it, like I said, on a global level and really how it's federally defined. So what is a specific learning disability? It's actually one of the most common disability categories for special education under IDEA. Most of you probably already know a few learning disabilities, even if you are not in the field or have not been trained in the area of a specific learning disability. The most commonly known specific learning disability is dyslexia. And dyslexia is always a specific learning disability, but a specific learning disability does not always mean dyslexia. So you can think about specific learning disability as like this umbrella term that encompasses different types of learning disorders. And so we have dyslexia, which is a learning disability in reading. We have dysgraphia, which is a learning disability in writing. And we have dyscalculia, which is a learning disability in math. Quick explanation before I get into the federal definition of what a specific learning disability is basically there are neurological impairments in someone's cognitive functioning that's causing significant learning challenges. So the theory here is that your brain has a bunch of different cognitive processes, and in a specific learning disability, one or more of those cognitive processes are impaired. And that is hypothesized to impact your ability to understand and use language, which could be spoken language, written language. So, and that obviously includes academic areas such as reading, writing, and math. SLD can sometimes be hereditary, and so that's one of the many data points that we often gather and discuss with families is, do you know if learning disabilities run in your family? Do you know if dyslexia runs in your family? Just because it runs in your family doesn't mean that you're going to have it, but it's one of the very many pieces of data points that can be helpful in an evaluation. But at this point in time, just like with many of our psychological and psychiatric disorders, we don't truly know why they occur. We can kind of come up with a profile, a battery of symptoms, so to speak, that people exhibit that qualify for these areas, such as a learning disability, but we don't know the root causes of them yet. So let's get into the nitty-gritty, the federal definition of what a specific learning disability is. And I will link this in the show notes as well, so you can see in IDEA law how it's defined, and make sure to check out your particular state's law for special education for a learning disability, because it's probably going to vary just a little bit. But generally speaking, the way IDEA defines it is SLD is a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes. And I want you to keep that in mind because that is a really important semantic piece in the definition. So it's a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes involved in understanding or in using language, spoken or written, that may manifest itself in the imperfect ability to listen, think, speak, read, write, spell, or do mathematical calculations. And it goes into further detail and defines what those academic underachievement areas are. So there's very specific categories for academic underachievement for SLD. We have reading, which encompasses your basic reading skills, your reading fluency, and your reading comprehension. We have written expression, and then we have math, which includes your math calculation, and then your math problem solving, which is a little bit more of like an applied concept for math versus just calculating math problems. And then the last two, which are a little less common, include oral expression and listening comprehension. So the interesting thing to know about learning disabilities is that my understanding is historically, and most often, The idea is that they occur in people with at least average cognitive abilities. So going back to that processing disorder definition and theory and framework under IDEA is that you have a person, again, theoretically, with overall average cognitive abilities, but they have one or more processing areas that are not within the average range and that are significantly affecting their ability to process and use information. And that shows up academically. That's really the theory behind it. However, this is changing quite rapidly and is subject to interpretation for a variety of reasons. So the first reason is the field is starting to change on whether or not they believe learning disabilities only or primarily apply to people with intact cognitive abilities. The second piece is how IQ, intellectual quotients, or basically intelligence, are being defined and analyzed by both school psychologists and private psychologists. We're not going to get into this right now, but the kind of common lingo here is the never-ending arguments between scatter matters and scatter doesn't matter in terms of your profile. Like I said, not going to get into a whole intelligence discussion now, but just know that even in terms of how we are categorizing overall cognitive abilities can vary very significantly by psychologist. To give a quick example, let's go back to one of the most commonly known and identified learning disabilities, dyslexia. A learning disability in reading. Typically here, the idea is you have a processing deficit in a couple very specific areas is really where most of the research is pointing to right now. We're going to have another episode eventually on the podcast where we give really our full attention to dyslexia because it's that big of a topic. But the areas that you might have heard of are phonological processing, orthographic processing, rapid naming. So usually when a child is identified with dyslexia in the school setting, it's because they have a processing disorder in one of those areas that's impacting their ability to achieve on grade level for reading and to learn to read. So there's actually, just like there's a ton of misconceptions about learning disabilities, there are a ton of misconceptions and a ton of myths about dyslexia. And part of the reason is because it's become such a popular term and so well known as a term in the general population, which is a good thing, but then there's a lot of myths and we won't get into those today. But what is important to know, as I mentioned earlier, is that dyslexia is a type of learning disability in reading. And schools do test for dyslexia when warranted under IDEA. And that's where I say make sure you listen to that podcast episode, because we don't test just to see, we don't test just because, we test for very specific reasons in the school setting. And again, because this isn't a blood test, urine test, black and white, yes or no, positive, negative type of test, and it takes significant data gathering and analysis, there are a lot of things we have to make sure are not the root cause of academic underachievement, so that we are not accidentally confusing other issues or other factors, I should say, as a learning disability, because they can often look similar to specific learning disabilities, but are not. The law actually recognizes this and clearly outlines that the underachievement must not be primarily related to some specific factors. Those include things like vision, hearing, or motor disabilities, intellectual disabilities, emotional disabilities, cultural, environmental, or economic disadvantage, and limited English proficiency. A lot of those things can look like underachievement and can cause underachievement in some cases, but are not a learning disability. And some of these kind of exclusionary factors, so to speak, have come up in part because people have historically been misidentified as having a learning disability when it's really due to these other potential disabilities or factors. And so one of the biggest ones we used to see and still sometimes see are children with limited English proficiency, otherwise known as, you know, people who are learning English as a second language. They can commonly be misidentified as having a learning disability because they're not achieving on grade level with their English speaking peers. And so historically, people would sometimes misidentify them as, oh, well, that means you have a learning disability. Well, it could mean you have a learning disability. And we certainly don't want to swing too far in the opposite direction, because I see that happening inappropriately as well, which is people refusing to consider specific learning disability for a kid solely because they speak another language or solely because they're learning English. There's a lot of caveats and nuances here, but we just need to be careful. And then the other, I would say, just as important factor that we need to consider when it comes to a learning disability is that the issues are present despite appropriate instruction. So we need to make sure that it's not due to a student having poor attendance or limited school experience, because again, that can cause academic underachievement. If you've been missing a lot of school, you may have missed a lot of the foundational blocks you need to have effective and on grade level reading, writing, and math skills. Other thing about effective and appropriate instruction is that we should be meeting students at different levels, which means we should be providing evidence-based interventions in reading, writing, and math to students who need it before saying that they have a learning disability. Specific learning disability is one of those areas where it is so important to try interventions before jumping to the most restrictive setting of special education, before jumping to the conclusion that this student has a disability in learning. Remember how I said before, there's not just one test that comes up positive or negative that says, yes, you have a learning disability, or no, you don't. It's a bunch of data points, and one of the big pieces of data points is not responding to evidence-based interventions. So despite us using all of our best practices, all of our scientific knowledge on how to teach kids to learn, and trying to give you that additional bolster of supports, you're still not making sufficient progress. That is when we can really say, yeah, there's probably something else going on here. There are actually a lot of kids who are able to make progress and sufficient progress to get back on grade level, to get back on track when they're given the chance through evidence-based interventions. That doesn't mean that they have a learning disability. And I think that while oftentimes identifying a disability is appropriate, we start to lose track of how big of a decision that is and how potentially life-changing that is for children. And I think the reason we lose sight of that as a population in general, not just educators, but families as well, is that when students aren't doing well, we begin to understandably become flustered and stressed, and we just want to, quote, fix the problem. And we see a child struggling and we just want to help. But it's important to know that what actually is the best thing for a child is to stay within the general education setting and in their least restrictive environment as much as possible for them to succeed. Now, for some students, the least restrictive environment is special education and additional supports. For other kids, that's just receiving evidence-based interventions. So this is a really nuanced process, and I think that's important for people to remember when we're talking about learning disabilities, is it's not black and white. It's not as simple as just you have it or you don't. There is a lot of data gathering, data processing, data analysis, and a bunch of considerations that go into determining if we believe a student has a learning disability or not. Now that we've talked about what a learning disability is, we're going to talk a little bit about how you qualify for the initial criteria for a specific learning disability. And again, this is in the public education system under IDEA law, so under federal law. There are really three methods that schools are allowed to use in determining if a student qualifies for a learning disability for special education purposes. And before we get into those, I want you to remember, and this came from episode 2 where we talked about special education law, for every single disability, no matter what it is, in terms of special education, it is never enough to have a private diagnosis. That's never sufficient. It's a piece of data. And you must not just have the profile of that disability, but it must adversely affect your access to your education. And it must require that you need special education services for you to qualify overall under a category for special education. that's as far as I'm going to go because I went into that a lot in the episode on overview of special education law. But just keep that in mind when I talk about the methods for qualification. This is really for meeting criteria for a specific learning disability. But again, we need to make sure it's in terms of qualifying for an IEP for this, that it's adversely affecting your education and you require special education for it. So there's three methods. There's the discrepancy model, there's the pattern of strengths and weaknesses, which you'll hear referred to as PSW, and then there's response to evidence-based intervention, which you'll commonly refer to as RTI. Now, discrepancy model is the oldest, most traditional, you could say, most commonly used slash trained in model for identifying a learning disability. But it also gets the most hate for a variety of reasons, and many of them are good. Basically, the discrepancy model, I'm going to go through this kind of generally, is the idea that your IQ, so your intelligence, is severely discrepant from your academic achievement. So let's say we have a child who has an IQ that's in the average range, but they have academic achievement that's in the significantly below average range. Under the discrepancy model, that's what that means, but there also needs to be a processing disorder or deficit, whatever you want to call it, that is hypothesized to be the reason then that that student is underachieving academically. If your overall intelligence is in the average range, but you're not achieving on grade level, then what's going on? The hypothesis here is like, oh, you have this processing disorder that's impacting your reading. So like, oh, your phonological processing is well below the average range, and that's consistent with your reading difficulties that are discrepant from your overall IQ. One of the main issues that people have with the discrepancy model, it's your more traditional, what people refer to as like a wait to fail approach, because the student has to reach a certain level of failure really to have that discrepancy between their IQ and their achievement. And as we talked about a little bit earlier, there are more and more differences in terms of what people consider to constitute an overall IQ nowadays. The other issue with the discrepancy model is that some states and some districts are very specific about what a severe discrepancy is. So like how many standard deviations, how many points of a difference. So for example, in California, I believe the law says it's 1.5 standard deviations, which is 22 points. In other states, it's not defined at all. In other districts, it's not defined at all. And so then that leaves a lot of interpretation and subjectivity in a model that was supposed to be very clear cut and theoretical, ideally, was the plan there with the discrepancy model, but we're seeing is not really the case so much. And because of that, the law has now stated that the discrepancy model cannot be the only way that a student can qualify for a learning disability. There must also be other ways that they are able to potentially qualify. They could qualify with the discrepancy model, but if they don't, you can't say that's all we use here. Let's move on to the next model, PSW, Patterns of Strengths and Weaknesses. This is the shiny new version of the discrepancy model, in my opinion. And it is newer, probably gets some hate from some of the strong-willed, passionate PSW people. But in my opinion, that it really is just a version of the discrepancy model that's a little more lenient. So I think there's pros and cons to both models. And I think PSW has a lot of issues as well. And basically, the idea behind PSW very quickly is that you have a pattern of strengths and weaknesses, just like it sounds. So you have a pattern of cognitive strengths that align with academic strengths and cognitive weaknesses that align with your academic weaknesses. And there doesn't necessarily need to be a severe discrepancy between your overall IQ and your achievement, as long as we can see these patterns of strengths and weaknesses within your cognitive profile and achievement profile that match up. And so again, you do need to have a cognitive processing disorder that is tied to the academic area of underachievement. But this gets really subjective because just like with the discrepancy model, some states and districts say what is a severe discrepancy and some don't. With PSW, some states very clearly and districts say This is how we're identifying PSW and the processing softwares that we're using to identify PSW and define what exactly makes a strength and what exactly makes a weakness. And many, many other districts and states absolutely do not do that. And so you get a very subjective model without a lot of great training, without a lot of great fidelity, without a lot of great research behind it in many cases. Now, the last model, the third model, is probably the best in theory, but there's issues with it as well. And so I think what you're starting to hopefully catch on to by now, unfortunately, is that we're working with three different models that are really not any of them being the best, but we're working with where we are in the field of psychology right now with specific learning disabilities. So RTI, response to evidence-based intervention, the best idea in theory for qualification so far. It's basically that despite evidence-based intervention, you're not making sufficient progress to meet grade level standards. Now, that sounds great, but it's extremely rare that schools are actually implementing it with fidelity, that schools are selecting appropriate evidence-based, scientific-backed interventions for students correctly, that they're picking the one the student needs, that then they're implementing it with fidelity, that they're progress monitoring with fidelity, that they're meeting at regular intervals to track the student, adjust the intervention, and provide intervention for the appropriate length of time, and then see, is the student not necessarily just automatically on grade level, but are they making the expected progress to get back to a grade level? So it is extremely subjective. It's subject to a lot of errors, and like I said, oftentimes not done with fidelity. I'm not saying it can't be done with fidelity. I'm not saying in some places it's not done with fidelity. I'm sure that is the case in some places, and some places probably have amazing RTI systems. But as a national universal model for identifying a learning disability, it's really one of those, that sounds like a great idea, but in practice doesn't really work. The other thing is that it doesn't actually match the federal definition of a learning disability. If you remember earlier when I was reading you the federal definition of a learning disability, I told you that SLD is a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes. That's like the first part of the definition. And so with response to evidence-based intervention, you're not necessarily identifying a cognitive processing disorder. You're just basically saying the student isn't making progress to learn, which kind of goes more towards MTSS in general, multi-tiered systems of support, which will be another episode entirely. So I think that RTI is best when utilized with other methods and not just by itself. That's for one reason. Basically, RTI must be allowed as a method, I believe, for qualification. And so you'll usually see either all three models that I just described, or you'll see RTI with discrepancy model or RTI with patterns of strengths and weaknesses as ways that district can identify learning disabilities. So now that we've kind of covered as comprehensively, broadly speaking as I can, what a learning disability is and some of the issues that we're at with learning disabilities, let's just talk about some other general issues here. Processing disorders. What are they exactly? Good question. Some states have them very clearly defined. IDEA does not have them defined. They just use the word processing disorders. Some states like California are like, these are the processing disorders we've agreed to, and this is what you can use, and that's it. Other states do not have that at all. They also just say processing disorders, and they leave it up to the districts, which can be good and can be quite horrible. Because then, again, we have a lot of subjectivity and a lot of practitioners doing things differently and creating processing areas that maybe no other psychologist has ever created or that no other district has. And so you can see here that a lot of these models turn out to be subjective. Discrepancy model was really trying its best to be as kind of statistic-driven and data-driven, but we saw that it had a lot of issues as well. The problem really is that the science and theory is just not fully caught up yet for learning disabilities and even privately for learning disorders. So we still have a long way to go. It's not because of a lack of caring or trying or training. The science just is not quite there yet. And so we're doing the best we can with the models and research and data that we have at this time. I do think if, in terms of special education, one of the criteria for a learning disability is a processing disorder, we should at least all be in agreement as to what the processing areas are. But we're not. That is definitely a problem in the field if we can't even universally agree upon like what our cognitive processing areas. All right, a couple more things to talk about here. So the difference between private practice and special education or school setting identification. Private practice, you get a diagnosis, and that diagnosis comes from the DSM. In public education and school psychologists, you get an educational diagnosis, so to speak, or an identification or a qualification for special education purposes. And that comes through IDEA law and not the DSM. And they have different criteria. They are defined differently. I'm not in private practice as a psychologist, but my understanding from the DSM and in talking to private psychologists are that it's a little bit easier to meet criteria for a learning disorder through the DSM than it is for a learning disability through IDEA for special education. I think one of the big differences in private practice is you don't necessarily need a processing disorder. That's not to say they aren't sometimes identified there, but I don't think that's part of the DSM criteria. And so you see a lot of children meeting criteria for diagnoses for learning disabilities kind of simply because they're not achieving on grade level. Obviously, their evaluations are also comprehensive, and they're not just throwing diagnoses out there. They're making sure that it's not due to other disabilities, but it's a little bit easier to qualify. And they don't always have the same data that the school might in terms of response to interventions. And in some ways, that's okay because it's a separate process than special education. But in other ways, it makes it very confusing for parents and families, and it can kind of become school system versus private medical system, and it just gets tricky and challenging, and it becomes a very semantic-based thing, and parents become really frustrated. The other thing I've said earlier, and I want to keep repeating, is that a diagnosis does not equal special education, which, like I said, can be confusing for families, frustrating for families, I'm sure. But IEPs are for educational disabilities as defined by IDEA. IQ is also a problem. We talked about that earlier because whether or not we want to say it's related to learning disabilities for special education, if we're talking about processing disorders, we are talking about intelligence in some capacity, because how else are you going to identify a processing disorder? And there's a lack of consensus on what constitutes intelligence and IQ. Again, back to that like varied profile thing. So does scatter matter? Does scatter not matter? There is a whole debate going on in the field of psychology and school psychology right now around that. The last thing I want to point out, and I say last thing because we're running out of time on this episode today. We've talked for quite some time now, but the last thing I want to point out is another challenge, which is the lack of consensus on if learning disabilities appropriately are applied to children who don't have average IQ. And I'm not talking about children who have intellectual disabilities or are in that borderline range of an intellectual disability, but what I'm really talking about are children whose IQ are below average, but not severe enough to be an intellectual disability. And like I mentioned earlier, we're seeing this more and more, and I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that there's a lack of consistency and kind of a shift in thinking around that. And the question we really need to wrap our heads around is getting more theory and better solid consensus and understanding around what are learning disabilities, and is having below average IQ a disability? Not an intellectual disability, but is it a disability? Because when we're talking about SLD for special education purposes, remember that special education is a law for children with educational disabilities as defined by the federal and state law. Now, will kids who have below average IQ struggle in school academically? Most likely, yes. Should they get more support? Yes. Does that mean that more support is special education? I don't know. That's not just for me to answer. That's not like a simple question to answer. But so far, I wouldn't say the answer in terms of like an actual approach and theory and law is yes. But in terms of what we're seeing in practice, it starts to turn into a yes, both in terms of private provider recommendations and many school psychologists, because there seems to be no other answer, which is not necessarily the right answer. Many schools don't have the supports and systems in place to support students who don't fit in the box of you either have a disability or your general education and you don't. And so that can create a lot of issues and disservices to really all learners, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. But I just wanted to throw that out as something for us to consider. And another kind of issue that is going on within the field of psychology and learning disabilities. I hope today's episode was helpful in giving you an overview and understanding of what specific learning disabilities for special education are or are not, and some of the issues and areas for growth in our field. And I look forward to continuing this conversation with all of you in future episodes, delving a little bit deeper into some specific learning disabilities, as well as on other platforms such as Instagram and sometimes TikTok, but that gets a little scary. So feel free to message me on Instagram and we can have some good conversations on Instagram Lives and certainly do some additional episodes to delve deeper into learning disabilities. Thank you all for joining me. Thanks for tuning into the School Psych Finds podcast. Join our community by subscribing and following me on my other channels, which can be found in the show notes. Lastly, if you enjoyed the podcast, it makes a huge difference if you leave a quick review. I'll see you all soon for our next School Psych Finds.